Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Yes, it is. Thank you for being with us. McNeil and Parkins on the score. I'm Danny Parkins. Danny Mac still recovering from the vocal cord injection. He is the definition of day-to-day, but really, as they say, aren't we all? This segment is brought to you by Indeed. Are you hiring? With Indeed, you can post the job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates in an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/hire. The optimism around the Bears is a good thing. I hope it translates into Bourbonnais. I think it's higher this year than it was last year with Mitch Trubisky. That's kind of funny to me based off the draft, but if you're putting it in with the draft and free agency and the upgrade at head coach, even if it's just addition by subtraction of getting John Fox and that staff out of here, I certainly understand it. Texter writes in, we don't even know if Trubisky is any good, and now the team is built around an uneven or an unproven prospect. I did a radio appearance in Houston yesterday for a reason that doesn't really matter right now. I was on doing a national show, and they heard me say something about Houston, and the guy booked me to come on, and we ended up talking about last year's quarterback class. And it's a funny thing. Like, I've got some good friends that work in Houston. Obviously, I worked in Kansas City, and now I work here. And those are the three markets that will trace last year's 2017 draft for a decade. And if you polled Houston fans and said, are you happy with Deshaun Watson? 90%+ say yes. Little concerned about the knee injury, his second knee reconstruction, but there is a 90%+ approval rating for Deshaun Watson in Houston. If you polled Chiefs fans and said, are you happy with and optimistic about Pat Mahomes? All he's done is play in a couple of preseason games and start week 17 last year. 90%+ would say yes. And if you polled Bears fans here, are you happy with Mitch Trubisky and optimistic about Mitch Trubisky going forward? I think, what do you think, Shep? 70% would say yes? Optimistic about Mitch Trubisky going forward?
Yeah. Like, if it's more thumbs up than thumbs down, at least 70%.
Yeah, I'd say at least 70%. So what's interesting about that to me is that after 1 year, when Watson's the only one who really looked like a star, Trubisky did not look like a star for any real period of time, and Mahomes did not get that chance, but Mahomes is in a great situation, great offensive coach, great offensive playmakers. Trubisky now has, hopefully, a great offensive coach and great offensive playmakers, and we know what Deshaun Watson has in Houston. All three fan bases 1 year in are still totally convinced, at least a majority, and in a couple of places an overwhelming majority, that they got the right guy and they got the guy that's going to be good. Look, the jury is still out on that class. I think it is still absolutely possible that the Bears got the best quarterback in that draft, and I was a guy who wanted Watson taken 1-1. So this is a huge year to see if at the end of the year he still keeps up with those other guys, because Mahomes is going to look good in Kansas City. He's got too good of a coach and too good of playmakers with Tyreek Hill, Sammy Watkins, Kareem Hunt, and Travis Kelce. It's a great, like, he's going to be a good fantasy quarterback this year. Their defense isn't as good. He is going to put up numbers this year. We know what Watson can look like. And now we'll see if at the end of the year, now that Trubisky has Nagy and Robinson and Burton and Gabriel and the investment in the offensive line and Miller and everything that he now has, and it being year two, and the expectation of it not taking as long now as it used to, because we know that Matt Nagy is going to not force Mitch Trubisky to do pro-style stuff. He's going to build an offense around his skill set, the stuff that he did well at North Carolina. There's an expectation that Mitch Trubisky is going to have a good year this year. And if Mitch Trubisky fails, it won't be because it's the Bears' fault. Like, this will not be a Sam Bradford with the Rams, Jay Cutler at times with the Bears. Like, they are investing in Mitch Trubisky. The draft only continued to show that. The coaching hire showed it. Free agency showed it. The draft showed it. They're doing everything in their power to make sure that Mitch Trubisky is good. And we'll see if he is by the end of the year. But that's why, more so than any individual pick, I liked the draft so much. It just makes sense. It's not hard to follow the logic of what Ryan Pace is doing. Need a captain in the defense? Check. Need to solidify Whitehair's position and protect your franchise quarterback? Check. Need another wide receiver, another playmaker, another pass catcher, because you had the worst group in the league last year, and Gabriel and Burton are both inside slot guys. You didn't re-sign Meredith. Allen Robinson's an outside guy. Need another outside guy? Check. It just makes sense. And that's a really refreshing thing. But so, yeah, if you talk to Chiefs fans, they think Mahomes is going to be the best QB of that class. If you talk to Texans fans, they're convinced Deshaun Watson is going to be the best QB of that class. And we here in Chicago have the biggest question of the three. But if you remember, said that on draft day, or the day after draft day, because it was, in theory, the best talent, Trubisky, he was taking the highest, in the worst position. Because of the coach and the players around him. Ryan Pace is now trying to change the situation around him, and we'll see if Trubisky can live up to the draft position that he plays in. Len Casper's going to join us early, and coming up in 10 minutes, so I want to get a few Cubs and Brewers thoughts out of the way. The Brewers are hilarious, man. Like, they want it to be a rivalry so badly, and proximity allows it to be a rivalry, and the Twitter accounts make it a rivalry. The only place the Brewers can get a win over the Cubs is apparently on Twitter. And then the Cubs still get the majority of wins in that space also. The Cubs social media account is fantastic. But the Brewers, I'm not saying they won't play big games against the Cubs in August and September. They very well might. They're only a game back of the Cubs in the standings. But the Brewers are clearly trying to be Pepsi to the Cubs Coke, right? Like, it's the Pepsi challenge for a reason. You try to punch up. The Brewers with the ticket sale thing, with the trash talk, with the social media accounts, with all of that. Like, they try to punch up to make it a rival. Council with the line about, you know, the only time I've ever needed to use sunscreen in a rainout. Like, they're trying to get under the Cubs' skin and needle the Cubs and get the attention of their players to be like, no, you belong on the same field as the former world champs. And the Cubs owned them. They won all low-scoring games. They scored 9 runs in 4 games and got 4 wins. There was a stat that showed on the broadcast over the weekend that now with Bryant back, that Bryant and Rizzo have only been, at that time, in the lineup together in 12 of the 24 games through that point in the season. So when you sit here and you look at all of the weather, all of the delays, Zobrist injury, the Brian injury, obviously, and the amount of time off that those guys have had to have, Rizzo with the bad back and the short DL stint, and the team that we all think is going to be the second best team in the division, not even the same class as the Cubs. The games were close, but not in the same class. And you saw what the potential is of the Cubs rotation and really the Cubs pitching staff. Everyone's talking about the Cubs rotation, and they should. Quintana was great, a 2-hitter with 8 strikeouts in 7 innings. Chatwood started rough in the first inning yesterday, but only 2 hits over 7 shutout innings against the Brewers. Darvish, after the back-to-back bad starts, he had the unearned run that was unfortunate off of the Hayward error in right when the wind was going crazy. But he's now had 2 starts against the Brewers this year, only given up 1 earned run, had 8 strikeouts in 6 innings, looked like vintage Yu Darvish, nasty movement. And then, of course, Hendricks with 5 Ks, no walks, 7 shutout on the first game of the series. What is that, 4 days ago? And then Morrow and Edwards looked like a lockdown back into the bullpen with Cishek as your middle closer. Cishek comes in if there's ever a jam in the 6th or 7th. Edwards has the 8th. Morrow has the 9th. They've been automatic. And Lester goes tonight, but the rotation is pitching up to its ability, and we finally, my God, finally, got nice weather in Chicago. Like, this is going to be the first time when there's good weather for a Cubs homestand all season. May 1st is tomorrow, right? 30 days in April. finally we're going to get good weather for a Cubs home game, and it's going to not come until April 30th. So the bats, in theory, should pick up. Rizzo and Bryan are back in the lineup together. Baez and Almora are rolling at the top of the lineup. Both went 0-for-4 yesterday, had their dozen-game hit streaks, or I think it was an 11-game hit streak going for 12. Both had an end on the same day. But they're not technically in first place, but it feels like they are, because we know that Pittsburgh is no threat whatsoever to the Cubs, and the team that everyone thought could maybe be a threat to the Cubs, the Brewers, you just got rid of them with light work. The games were close, the games were tense, the games were fun, but there's nothing that I saw from Milwaukee at any point this season over the two series that they've played, both in Milwaukee and here, that there's no reason to believe that the Brewers are going to be a legitimate competitor to the Cubs if the Cubs are healthy. They're just better. They're just in a different class. And the most encouraging thing by far is that the starting pitching actually is on a roll. The bullpen stuff is great, but we know how fickle that is. But Quintana and Chatwood and Darvish looking good. I've never had a concern about Hendricks, but Chatwood especially, after that first inning yesterday, it's so weird that we're now conditioned to count mound visits also. Contreras went out there for a first inning mound visit, and that's a thing, whereas in the past that would be nothing. But that's like a big thing in broadcast. They tally it up on the scoreboard. It's a big thing. Oh, Contreras using that mound visit wisely, like it's a timeout in the second half of a football game. And he gets out of the first inning and he settles down and it's two hits the entire way. But the Cubs just, they feel like they're really good. The numbers are very similar to last April, but now that the starting pitching is going on a roll and they've already had some early season adversity and they're positioned as well as they are, I never was worried about the team, but feels like they're ready for a big May. And I heard Burnsy talking about if they've put 500 in the rearview mirror. I wonder if by the end of this series, they'll put not the entire division, like it'll be over in the rearview mirror, but I expect this team to spend the overwhelming majority of the summer in first place, and hopefully most of it comfortably in first place, so that August and September is not as much of a slog as it was last year. We'll talk about the Cubs with Len Kasper, but he said something on social media about the great game of baseball that I think people will really enjoy hearing him talk about. So we're going to have a conversation with Len Kasper about the Cubs and baseball coming up next on The Score. Normally, Len Kasper joins the McNeil and Parkin show Mondays at 3 o'clock to talk about the weekend of Cubs baseball, but moving it up today with the earlier start against the Rockies. We always appreciate his time. How's it going, Len?
Hey, Danny. I'm actually sitting in the Cubs dugout watching some extra BP today on a very summer-like day. The wind is blowing straight out to center field, which is totally the opposite of pretty much every day we've seen here since the season started. So it's going to be a different vibe here tonight for sure.
Hold on while I go bet the over. But Len, I wanted to. We'll talk baseball in a second, or I guess we'll talk about the Cubs in a second. I loved this sentiment that you shared on Twitter over the weekend. You said, if I could only pick broadcasting or baseball, I'd choose baseball. I love broadcasting. It's in my DNA, but baseball goes deeper into my soul by a long shot. I adore the game more than I can even describe. Just being at the ballpark is life-affirming. It's a great sentiment. What prompted you to share that?
You know, nothing specifically. It was more, I think it was a sunny afternoon on Friday or Saturday, and it was very cold, and yet there were about 35,000 people in the stands. It was a really good ball game, and I just, you know, it was just one of those moments where it hits you how fortunate you are in my position to be able to come to Wrigley Field and every ballpark we go to and call it my career, my job. And I've often had this conversation with my colleagues about broadcasting and baseball, and I think, unlike other sports, I think you really have to have a passion for the game itself. You know, I think a lot of people who broadcast football have a passion for football or hockey or basketball, but I think baseball is different just because the amount of time we spend at the ballpark. I just got here at about 2:15. Game will start at 6. Probably get out of here at 9:30, 10 o'clock. So, you know, it's like a regular work day, and we do this for 6 or 7 or sometimes 8 months out of the year. And you know, when push comes to shove, I feel like I'm a little closer to baseball than I am to broadcasting. And I love broadcasting. I know you do, too. It's why you do it for a living. But I love the sport so much, and I just wanted to express it in that way.
It was great, and it did relate to me because I do love broadcasting, but I was, after college, I had the choice, like, I could go and try to do behind-the-scenes stuff in Chicago, and I love Chicago, and it's all the only place I ever wanted to work, or I could try to go to a smaller market and host and work my way back to Chicago, which is what I obviously did, because I decided, as much as I loved Chicago and Chicago sports, I loved hosting more. So for me,
right,
hosting was in my DNA and my soul more necessarily than needing to do it in Chicago. Like, I would have been happy doing it wherever, as successful as I could have been, if Chicago would have never come. So I guess, why baseball over broadcasting?
I just, it always takes me back to being, you know, 10 to 15. And as a sports fan and as a baseball fan, and I started playing tabletop baseball and started kind of calling games in my head and started going to a fair amount of major league games, you know, two or three a year, which was a lot for me being from a very small town, watching games on cable every day prior to, you know, 1982. Basically, it was just two or three games a week were only available. So I guess when I have those moments of kind of reverting to my childhood, it always comes back to a baseball memory. And I played baseball through high school. I find the game intellectually incredibly stimulating. I would like to think of myself as a curious human being. And I just feel like every day there's something I can learn about baseball that I didn't know the day before. And it's that part of it is really, really important. There are a lot of other sports where I think, you know, generally the same game kind of happens with a few differences in the middle of it, whereas baseball, no two games ever feel the same to me.
We're talking to Len Casper. He's at Wrigley Field. No, it was a great sentiment, and people can read it at Len Casper on Twitter. I thought it was an interesting thing. And I think a lot of baseball people agree with you.
I'll tell you, one of the Cubs players came up to me, actually, and said, hey, I saw your post on Twitter, and actually we got into a big conversation about it. So that made me feel good that an actual major league player who feels the same way about the sport as I do saw it and thought it was pretty neat.
Yeah, those are big words that you were using, not in terms of letters or syllables, but like being at the ballpark is life affirming. You know what I mean? Like, how would Len Casper do the rankings of things in his life? Like, is it family or baseball, or is it baseball or family?
No, it's family, but it's, you know, I've likened Wrigley Field to Central Park. And when we go to New York, I always make sure to jog through the park. And it's one of my favorite places in the world. And I think Wrigley is a lot like it. It's this green oasis in the middle of this urban setting. And so, you know, I get to come here, you know, 80 plus times a year. And I just always feel better about life when I'm in this ballpark.
That's great stuff. You love learning things through baseball. What did you learn about the Cubs and their relative position compared to the Brewers over the weekend?
Well, I think a couple of things. Number one, we talk about regression to the mean, and for the Cubs, they had kind of been middling around the 500 mark, and I think their regression, in air quotes, would be back to a team that should be near the top of the division, winning more than they lose. It's a team that had what I thought was one of the best starting rotations in baseball and really hadn't shown that in the first three or four weeks of the season. I don't know if we've learned anything about the Cubs vis-a-vis the Brewers or vice versa. Sometimes it's hard to explain a matchup and why you're really successful against one team versus maybe not another. I think the Brewers are a really good club. Their record is such that they've beaten up on the teams they should beat. And they're playing the Reds this week in Cincinnati, and they probably should win two out of three, if not that whole series. You can hang around by beating teams you should beat. But I think for the Brewers to maybe get to that next step, there is going to be a point where they're going to have to be competitive with the Cubs. And they were last year. I think they won the season series 10-9. So, you know, I wouldn't make too much of what's gone on between the two clubs. I would just say, from the Cubs' perspective, what we've seen here the last week seems to represent more of what I think we'll see much of the rest of the year.
I want to talk about a few of the specifics with you from over the weekend. We appreciate Len Casper being willing to hold with us through the update. Back in on the McNeil and Parkins show, we'll have Michael Lombardi in 90 minutes to talk football and the draft. Len Casper joining us from the ballpark. He's in the dugout ahead of Cubs and Rockies. We appreciate his time every Monday. Chris Bryant getting back from getting hit in the face, and he had that C-flap over his helmet. Do we have any word yet on if that's going to be a continuing thing for him?
We do not. At some point, I am going to ask him. My money would be on that he'll continue to wear it. I think I liken it to a seatbelt. I think once you do it for a week or so, you feel almost naked without it. and you know, Baez, Almora, Hayward, who got hit in the face a few years ago. There are a lot of guys around baseball, I'd say three or four per team, who are now wearing that just to have a little extra peace of mind. So my hunch is that, he'll continue to wear it unless he feels like he's having a hard time seeing the ball. But, you know, he looks like the same old Chris Bryant to me, even though I don't think he has a hit since coming back. And it's just a matter of time before he gets in a groove. He got off to a really good start.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask. Like, you watch, I was watching it as closely as I could, but you're there and you can see it closer than I can. Like, if you felt like he looked the same, even though the results haven't been there.
Yeah, he's working deep counts. You know, I haven't felt like that he's flinched at all on a couple of pitches that were maybe up and in. And for most guys, they'll just tell you that the sooner you can get back in there and try to not think about what happened, the better off you're going to be. And I think he'd be the first to tell you he was really fortunate that it wasn't worse than it was. It could have been a real bad one.
You don't normally get four wins against a good team when you're only scoring nine runs. How much value do you attribute, if any, to, hey, we can win low-scoring close games?
Well, that had been the really interesting thing about the first few weeks is that they were winning the 14-10 and the 9-2 game, and they were losing a lot of the 1-0, 2-1 game. And if you look at what they did in this series, they were able to flip the script a little bit. You know, over the course of a long season, you're going to win your fair share of 1-0, and you're going to lose your fair share. It's just kind of the luck of the draw. And you know, the one-run decision thing tends to be pretty random. The best teams in baseball, Danny, as you know, like the Red Sox and the start they've had, generally they're going to win the blowouts, right, because they're really good. So I wouldn't make too much of it, but I think by the end of the year, the Cubs will probably have won about every variety of game there is to win. And what I would chalk it up to is not only really good pitching, but I think the defense has really come into its own here in the last couple of weeks, led by Almora and Baez with the great series they had in Colorado. And they made some really good plays and some tough conditions in that series against Milwaukee.
Any of the performances of the starting pitchers stand out to you as maybe more impactful or meaningful than another one?
Well, I think the obvious one has to be Yu Darvish. You know, the fifth inning issue that we talked about last week when I was on the show, he gave up a hit to the pitcher and then walked Lorenzo Cain on a very competitive 3-2 pitch that Cain sat on that a lot of guys won't. And they'll swing at, and then he got out of that. I loved the way the crowd was with him. The chance of you, I think that'll continue here. I thought that was the most significant start we've seen over the last week by a long shot. I think he needed that confidence boost. He didn't get the win, but the Cubs did win the game, and he certainly pitched well enough to get a win.
Yeah, he looked like the Darvish of old, and I haven't really allowed myself to be concerned with him. I'm mildly annoyed at the small things that have given the blips on the radar for him, but like I know that Yu Darvish is a good pitcher. I'm excited to, like, does Chatwood start in this series? I didn't even look at it. He would not, right?
Chatwood will not. He'll miss the Rockies the whole year.
Yeah, so he misses the Rockies the entire year to go up against his old team. But when I watch him, it's unbelievable how much the ball moves. And I know that was the thing with the spin rate on the curveball and all that. But when you see it and you actually are looking for it, it's so noticeable. Do you feel like something clicked for him in the last start? Because he looked damn near unhittable.
He's going to walk people because the ball does move so much. I don't think he's a guy who necessarily is going to hit spots. He's going to aim for a general area and just let the movement of his pitches take over. And he's different, man, in that he can walk three or four guys and still find a way to get out of it because he's got that turbo sinker that can coax double play balls. And we saw a couple of those in the game yesterday. You know, obviously you don't want to walk five or six every start, but he's found a way to do it. And I think the biggest thing is he doesn't seem to get rattled. Even with a bases loaded, one out situation, he knows he's only one pitch away from escaping. And he was able to do that yesterday.
When you talk to Jim Hickey before every game, I don't know how much you've talked to him about Chatwood. Is that a tougher guy to coach or an easier guy to coach if it's like, yeah, just throw it to an area and your stuff's good enough that it'll work?
You know what, Danny? I'm going to ask him that question on the show tonight.
Okay.
How's that for you?
Well, yeah, because I watch him. Like, does he know where the ball is going? Like, I honestly don't know. But every time I watch him pitch, I'm like, it's really exciting. It's like an extra level of excitement, but it's not necessarily good because, like you said, of all the walks.
Well, he's not a comfortable at bat, and I think a lot of hitters will tell you that even guys who throw really hard, if the pitch is straight and if guys feel like they have good command and can hit their spots, you're going to get a good pitch to hit at some point, and with Chatwood, you're just never quite sure.
All right, well, enjoy the series and the game and batting practice and all that. We'll be listening pregame starting up at 5:30 right here on The Score. Thanks, Len.
Thanks, Danny.
All right, talk to you soon. That's Len Casper at the ballpark from Wrigley Field, normally at 3 o'clock, but a little early because of the earlier game. He always interviews Jim Hickey in the dugout, so maybe that's what he was about to do. I want to run a draft theory by you guys coming up at 3 o'clock, but there was a conversation that just happened. It was like a public discourse that happened over the weekend, and I just found it to be idiotic arguments that came from an idiotic tradition largely involving idiots. And I want to talk about it because it's just infuriating and we should be able to be above it. So we'll get into that coming up next on The Score. That's Michelle Wolf from the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the audio brought to you by Tomorrow Sleep, a new Tomorrow hybrid mattress designed by sleep experts at Serta Simmons. Visit gettomorrowsleep.com. Use code TRAFFIC3 for $200 off when you spend $500 or more. It's McNeil and Parkins on The Score. I'll talk some drafts coming up at 3 o'clock and how actually I think we'd be better off without a draft. Yeah. Talks about that on the national show. Going to outline it for you. Let you guys help me out with the finalizing that idea. We'll get into it coming up. But I don't know if you guys followed this story over the weekend. I love stand-up comedy. I know Chris Tannehill loves stand-up comedy. I think that stand-up comedy, it's here's a good way of describing the importance of it. Trevor Noah, who's the host of The Daily Show, was on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld. And he talked about how in South Africa and apartheid and post-apartheid, like stand-up comedy hadn't been legal. Like the satire wasn't legal. And it's a great thing that we have in America and that many places have, that ability to be satirists, to be commentators, to give your opinion without fear of retribution, right? It's an ancillary benefit of the First Amendment and freedom of speech. And so I love stand-up comedy. I love making jokes about the third rail issues and making people uncomfortable and not pulling punches from any direction, making jokes to the right, to the left, about the social issues of our time. I love it. It's great. You go to a stand-up comedy show and it just feels so like raw and pure and unvarnished. And if there's like an element of danger to it and some of the PC stuff in our world goes away. Like it's a great feeling to just go and laugh and not be offended. Even if they're telling jokes that are at your expense, if you will, like your religious affiliations expense, your racial expense, your gender expense, whatever the case may be. Like it's a fun and freeing thing to do. So I love stand-up comedy. I've read books about it and watched documentaries about it. I think it's like a really important thing in society. And I happen to love journalism. So I'm like one of the few that have tuned in the past to actually watch the White House Correspondents'. I'm a dork for it. But regardless of any of that, and this is not going to be a political thing. It really isn't. But it's about comedy's place. Like there are Seinfeld and Rock and a bunch of these comedians have talked about how they don't want to go and do college campuses anymore because the climate around stand-up comedy is so awful. Dave Chappelle locks your phone now if you go to shows so you can't film him, so nothing can be taken out of context and put on the internet and be used against him because we have this ability to be offended by jokes. Like, it's a crazy thing. You go to a comedy show, you see a comedian tell a joke, and you come out of it offended by it. And you can say, well, Danny, this wasn't a comedy show. This is the White House Correspondents' Dinner. They hired a comedian. She got paid to do that gig. And while I think some of the disingenuousness about that joke, where people who were defending Sarah Sanders, who largely aligned politically with her, were defending her and were quote-unquote outraged over the joke because that was about her physical appearance is what they were claiming. Like, the hypocrisy of that when on that same side of the aisle, the president, which Sarah Sanders defends, have told and said many comments about many people and their physical appearance, but they don't get outraged by that. Like, I recognize that hypocrisy. But I've seen that hypocrisy play out on any number of dozens of issues. What infuriated me were my journalism brethren. Now, and I'm not a journalist. I'm a talk show host. I'm a sports talk show host. But I always say, like, I have got that journalism club in my bag. Like, I know how to play it if and when the time comes, and I need it. And occasionally you need it. But, like Jim Acosta said, my problem with last night's dinner is not that we had a comedian who told some nasty jokes. It's that we did not really address the nearly constant attacks on the press from the president. The dinner should change with the times so we send a strong message to the world. Man, that was mentioned. Like, it was so disheartening to see so many members of the media be upset that Michelle Wolf's main commentary at the White House Correspondents' Dinner wasn't about how the president has taken shots at the press and called them enemies of the state, which, as a journalist, does offend me. Like, I get why members of the Washington Post or the New York Times or CNN or whatever, when the president says that they're fake news and that they're enemies of the state, like, I get why that offends their sensibilities. They're journalists. Their colleagues have died, like, for being journalists. The First Amendment is something to protect. If we're going to protect the Constitution, that one is a freedom of the press, is something that we absolutely should protect. Like, I get why that offends them. But Michelle Wolf was a hired comedian, and she also made the point that, hey, a bunch of you in this room, centrists, leftists, people on the right side of the aisle, the left side of the aisle, you built up the president, you profit off of the president, and now you want me to just take shots at him. What about you and your role in all of this? And that's fine. Like, that's just a reasonable commentary. But I saw so many people hand-wringing on the left, in the middle, media elites at their black tie event about, oh my God, it was a joke about her looks. Spare me. It was a joke about what, makeup? From the ashes of truth or lies? Like, that was not a joke about her physical appearance. But I had people from the New York Times and CNN and MSNBC rushing to Sarah Sanders' defense. Are you crazy? Are you crazy? You hired a comedian to tell jokes about the political infrastructure in Washington at a black tie function. And you're going to cry about the media elites not being protected in that spot? Like, I was so embarrassed for the journalists being offended over a joke by a comedian at a comedy show. We got to stop. Like, we've got to stop being offended and going after people for jokes. It's crazy to me. And it was just so unbelievably disingenuous from all sides. Like, the people on the right that were like, oh my God, a comment about someone's physical appearance. Stop. Stop. The leaders on that side have taken plenty of shots at plenty of people's physical appearance, and you know it. So stop with that. Faux outrage. That was ridiculous. But then on the left, when people were like, no, this comedian should have been outraged that this president does this, and she acknowledged that, the shots on the free press, but also was like, what about your role in all this? They were like, oh my God. She turned a mirror on us. It was ridiculous. And some of the greatest people and commentators of our time are comedians. I just love stand-up comedy so much. So it's part of being able to do this job, to do all of the things that we all love to do. And no one knew who Michelle Wolf was ahead of this. Like, I knew because I watch The Daily Show sometimes still. I'm one of the few. But, like, most people don't. So you've built her up into a huge star now, which, I mean, good for her. I didn't even think it was all that funny. I didn't even think she did that good of a job, frankly. But this outrage is so ridiculous. On all sides, none of you are really upset. None of you. But, oh my God, we had to turn it into something because that's what we do. It's ridiculous. So That's my high horse moment here. But in general, when you hire a stand-up comedian to tell jokes, general rule of thumb, don't be offended by the jokes. Just general rule. You go to a comedy show and you walk out of it offended, that's on you.
Are people offended, really? Or is it just gotcha culture and, you know, I want to make this about myself, so I'm going to say that this offends me?
I don't know. I think it's both, honestly. I think I find most of this outrage to be completely fabricated and hypocritical. I don't really believe anybody's offended by this, but I couldn't believe the amount of anger that people were displaying who were huge influencers on the right, on the left, media, everything. It was just so fake and so transparent and so hypocritical. And to make the larger point for a second, like, how are we ever going to find common ground if that upsets people? Like, they should stop the White House Correspondents' Dinner if this is how people are going to react. It's ridiculous. But beyond that, who cares about a thing that nobody watches on a network that nobody watches about journalism where people wear tuxedos? Like, who cares, right? I'm a dork, so I care about it a little bit. But like, the vast majority of people do not care. But if we can't even agree that that wasn't a big deal, we're in some serious trouble. It was a comedian who was hired to tell jokes who told jokes.
Do you think it was because not many people know or knew who Michelle Wolf is? And if it was like someone like Chris Rock saying those things, they would just eat it up because he's known as one of the best to ever do it. It was the fact that she's an unknown, people were like, hey, who are you to be saying this about me? I barely know who you are.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that was some of it. But you hired her. Like, I don't understand. What was it? Kimmel said no? You hired her. And you're turning her into a huge star. People say, oh, this isn't sports. Okay, I love stand-up comedy, and I love the First Amendment, and I love freedom of speech, and I'm going to talk about it. That was an absolutely ridiculous song and dance that everybody did over the weekend. It was, as I've been known to say, patently absurd, with an S and an H. But man, no one cared. You're like, oh, well, you're talking about it. No. No one cared about what she said until people started pretending to be outraged over it. And they could just pretend to be outraged over it to score some weird points with someone. I don't even know. Michelle Wolf, Jim Acosta, get out of here. Ludicrous controversy. One of the dumber ones I've seen. And most of them are dumb. Don't be offended by jokes told by comedians at comedy shows. Good rule of thumb to live by. Coming up next, the draft was great. I think the Bears did really well. We don't know. But I think the Bears could have done better if there was no draft. I want to talk about the idea of fundamentally changing how we do this. You're probably really against it. That's okay. I want to try to convince you of it coming up next on The Score.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during O'Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, oh.